So Om Gadat Vrandasya Gananjana Shilakaya Chakshuran Miritam Yenatas Bhai Shigurve Namaha. So we're systematically going over the Bhagavad Gita. We began on the Gita Jayanti Day, and previously the Gita Jayanti Day, the Sunday before that, we gave a summary of the events leading up to the Battle of Kurukshetra. And last week we spoke about the Gita in general, the names of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, the names of Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, the format of the Bhagavad Gita, and chapter one, most and all of chapter one, and Arjuna's bewilderment and his excuses at not wanting to carry out Krishna's orders. Now, maybe I'll ask you all a little question, see if you remember some of the things. How many sections is the Bhagavad Gita divided into, basic sections? 18 chapters, but how many sections? Three sections. The first section is the first six chapters. What does that section primarily deal with? Karma Yoga. Middle? Bhakti Yoga. And last six? Jnana Yoga. Okay, got it. Okay, so Arjuna has given all of his excuses, has become bewildered, dropped his bow, all that other nice stuff, and now text 7. Who's going to read text 7 for us? You all have Bhagavad Gitas, or some of you have Bhagavad Gitas?
I am confused about my duty, and I have lost all composure because no misery.
Very good.
In this condition, I am asking you to tell me for certain what is best for me. Now I am your disciple and so surrendered unto you. Please instruct me.
Very good. Very nice reading. So Arjuna is now confused and he's ready to surrender to Krishna. And in the next verse, let's see, text 11. Next verse, I'll just read this real quickly. He says, I shall find no means to drive away this grief, which is drying up my senses. I will not be able to dispel it, even if I win a prosperous, unrivaled kingdom on earth with sovereignty, like the demigods in heaven. And then in the ninth text, he actually tells Krishna, Govinda, I shall not fight. And the reason he's calling Krishna Govinda is he wants Krishna to please his senses. That's why Govinda means the pleaser of the senses and the pleaser of the cows. So we understand that we're supposed to please Krishna's senses instead of Krishna pleasing our senses. And I told the story about that with my mother last Sunday, if you remember. Remember the story I told? You don't remember the story. I told the story that it was an interesting story about my mother. She lives in New York, and she, remember the story? She said, who remembers the story? Parking space. She was looking, it's hard to find parking space in New York, so she prays to God, and she said, whenever I pray to God, there's a parking space comes right in front of me. So at least she's praying to God. That's like the demigods. They're called Sakama devotees. They believe in God. They pray to God, but they want something from him. Like we have this thing, Satyanarayan Katha, right? You've heard of that before? Where people are very much interested in what God can do for them. But there was one American politician who said, don't ask what God can do for you, but what you can do for God. Of course, I'm paraphrasing his words. You may recognize that quote, you know, Kennedy's quote, where he said, don't ask what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. So we're actually turning that around. That's actually bhakti, asking what you can do for Krishna. And then Krishna, in the 10th verse, it describes that Krishna begins to speak in the midst of both the armies, and Arjuna is completely grief-stricken. And so in the text 11 to 30, Krishna defeats what's called the argument for compassion. That means Arjuna had an argument that how can we kill these people because it's not compassionate to do so. So generally we think the person is the body, right? So if you kill the person or kill the body, then the person doesn't exist anymore. So it's cruel and unusual punishment. Now, this may be a little controversial, but in the Vedic system, they did have capital punishment. And I'll explain the reason for it. I know some of you may not like this idea that they had capital punishment. Well, the reason is that when people did something like murdering someone else, there was a reaction they got from it. Now, I'm not talking about the government right now. I'm talking about karma, right? If you kill someone, you act for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction, right? You all know that. So the law of karma is you do something, it'll be done to you. If you commit an abortion, you'll be aborted. Pretty heavy, isn't it? I wouldn't want to be aborted. So, anyway, so if I, let's say I kill Hrishikesh there. So, mercy? If I thought I could send people to Vaikuntha by killing them, I'd have a submachine gun here and be killing you all. It doesn't work like that. When Krishna kills you, not when I kill you. So, no, let's say I'm just walking down the street and kill Hrishikesh. So there's karma. Then a heavy karma for that. You know, there's the subtle law of nature. So what happens is if he's taken by a Vedic government and he's condemned to death and he's killed, that karma is eradicated right then instead of having to wait for the future of having it happen again. Because in the future, what would happen is that I'd have to take birth, he'd have to take birth, and he'd have to come back and kill me. And I don't want to wait for that. You understand? So in this way, it eradicates my karma. And plus, I've taken another birth free from that particular karma. I'm not dead. It's not the end of everything. It's not a cruel and unusual punishment. Death is not like that. It's just the continuation. As Krishna will see, Krishna will point that out, that wherever there is birth, death is certain. Wherever there is death, birth is certain. So it's just a part of the cycle of life. You can't avoid winter. Just like now, it's very cold out. I just want to make the announcement, we're going to have the feast inside tonight, okay? Not outside, it's too cold. So it's very cold. What can I do? I can't heat the whole outside. Even with global warming, it's not going to work like that. So as much as we'd like to think like that, global warming, it'll be tropical everywhere, we'll be eating mangoes in Nugaloka. That would be ecstatic. But it's not going to work like that. You can't heat the outside in the same way. You can't change someone's karma like that. There's a law of karma, and there's a law of birth and death. You can't change that. What is the death rate right now? 100%, right? What was it 20 years ago? What will it be 200 years from now? So what can you do about it? So, anyway, plus, if one dies in a religious war, we're not talking about terrorism or anything like that, but like a real religious war, then they get liberated anyway. So, and especially where Krishna is there, the battle of Kurukshetra, and all those other nice things that happen. So Krishna here starts defeating the argument of compassion, 11 to 30. We don't have time to read all these verses, but we'll have you read some of them. Read text 12. If someone could hear, read text 12. It talks about the eternality of the soul.
Never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be.
So Krishna is establishing the eternality of the soul. Knowledge means matter, spirit, and the controller of both. And so the next text is 13. Let's read that too. It's a very important text.
As the embodied soul continuously passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. A sober person is not bewildered by such a change.
Like Prabhupada would give the example that previously, we had a little boy's body, or he had a little boy's body, and now he has an older person's body. And those of us who are basically over 30 have experienced these changes. When you're real young, you know, you don't really think about it so much. But we see pictures of ourselves. Anyone seen a picture of themselves when they were a baby? You did. And it's different. Different body, isn't it? How cute it was. And now, no one has said that I'm cute the last 50 years. No, the last 60 years. No one has said anything like that about me. So it changes. You're changing the bodies. Even the scientists, like Prabhupada said, change. Understand that the soul, the cells of the body change. So in text 12, which we just read, in text 13, the soul is eternal and also eternally individual. This is also confirmed by the Upanishads. Nityo nityanam, chetanas chetananam, eko bahunam yovadadati kamam. The Svetasvatara Upanishad. Where there are many eternals. Nityo nityanam, plural. But there's one supreme eternal, and there's many, plural, there's many smaller eternals. So that's text 12. And so the Mayavadis, Prabhupada comments in his purport here, everybody knows what a Mayavadi is? I mean, we talk about that a lot. Anybody have any ideas what a Mayavadi is? What's a Mayavadi? Nobody knows. He considers everything to be illusion. Or as the Beatles said in the 1960s, what is that song? Yeah, Strawberry Fields Forever. Nothing is real, Strawberry Fields Forever. You ever hear that before? No, nobody's heard that before. All right, don't sing it. So, some people from the 1960s here. So they try to understand the Gita. Here's the little bees there. See the bees? Prabhupada said it's like licking on the outside of a bottle of honey to try to understand the Gita from the wrong perspective. From the Maya. Maya body means basically everything's illusion. Maya body. That God is illusion, you're illusion, this world is illusion. Everything's illusion except for their bank account. I remember one time I was preaching at a college in the university, and someone came up and said, "You're illusion, I'm illusion, we're all illusion." And I grabbed his bicycle. He had a bicycle. "Thank you. Because it's illusion anyway. Why are you complaining? And give me your wallet, too. That's an illusion, too." And then he started fighting about the illusion. So those who claim to be Mayavadis are very expert in fighting about illusion and being attached to the illusion. So that's a problem with the Mayavadis. And they can't understand the Gita, just like you can't understand the taste of honey by licking on the outside of the bottle of honey. So text 13. So this talks about the embodied soul, the transmigration. You see this very nice picture that was done under Srila Prabhupada's direction, where there's a little baby and the spiritual light is passing from the little baby to the young boy, up, to the guy with a mustache, and then down, to skin and bones, and finally the skeleton, and that's us. That's us. We're not talking about anything else. Actually, the Mahabharata says, the question is raised, what is the most wonderful thing? And the answer is, ahani, ahani, bhutani, gacchantiya, yamalayam. The most wonderful thing is that we see everybody going through this process, basically going to Yamaraj, which is the direct statement there. And we think, not me. Not me. I see everybody else. Just like I've been visiting people recently in the hospitals and in the nursing homes. And I'm thinking, they're so unfortunate, it's not going to happen to me. Everybody else will happen to. I will visit all of you, attend all of your funerals, speak at all of your funerals, say goodbye to all of you, but, you know, I'll be here. What do they say here? The last person in America, please turn the lights out, or something like that. I don't know if you ever heard that expression. So, that's the 13th chapter. The embodied soul passes from verse. In this body, from boyhood to youth to old age, and the same way the soul passes on to another body at the time of death. And text 14, so we could read that.
The soul is the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress, and appearance in due course are like appearance and disappearance of winter and summer seasons. They arise from sense perception or sign of worry, and one must learn to tolerate them without being disturbed.
Like if you think about today, just this, you know, what you did today, there's times when you felt distressed today, and there's times when you felt happy today. And it's something like a sine wave. I don't know if you ever studied, you know, engineering or anything like that. It goes up and it goes down. It's like peaks. Just like before I came to class, I was riding my bicycle. And sometimes there's these hills, and it's really difficult to go up the hill. But when you reach the top of the hill, it's ecstatic. I mean, so much happiness, you know. You're breathing hard, the heart's beating, oh my God, you're sweating. And then you reach the top of the hill, and guess what? Wow. So that's like this world. So here's the winter season, summer season, quenching the thirst. Text 15 we should read also. That refers to the last one.
The best among men are doing the person who is not disturbed by happiness and distress and is steady in both is certainly eligible for liberation.
Hmm. Very, very nice. So in other words, these things will occur naturally, but we have to remain steady in our service, in our activities, our duty, dharma. Here Krishna is talking about dharma. Whether you're happy, whether you're distressed, you function on the intelligent platform. What is the intelligent platform mean in Krishna consciousness? What does Krishna want? And also, what does Guru want? It's very important. We were speaking about this morning in class, that one of the aspects of the training that one gets in spiritual life, especially brahmachari training, brahmachari gurukule vasandanta guror hitam. He learns to work for the benefit of the spiritual master, which is non-different than the benefit of Krishna. He develops a close relationship with the spiritual master, and he sees it as his duty, just as much as all of you see as your duty to take care of your families, to eat every day, right? Nobody neglects eating? Anybody here forget to eat? Oh, good. You're a real yogi.
Well, sometimes things take precedence, and then it's good. 6 o'clock at night.
But I never forget. And most of us never forget to eat. So when we... So it's like that one doesn't forget the connection with Guru and functions according to the instructions of Guru. Okay? And text 16, who's going to read text 16 for us?
Those who are seers of the truth have concluded that of the non-existent material body, there is no endurance, and of the eternal, the soul, there is no change. This they have concluded by studying the nature of both.
Mm. I think this is pretty self-evident, that things that have a temporary existence, even though, just like Prabhupada explains it, like the frames in a film. Because nowadays we don't use film so much anymore. We have digital video. But previously they used to have film. And there were different frames. And they would pass one after the other. I think there were 25 frames a second in professional theater. They would pass in front of the lens. And then they would be gone. In other words, they wouldn't be seen until the next showing, of course. So in the same way, whatever we're experiencing at present is gone. Like this body, or we're changing bodies constantly. So the next text 17. Who's going to read 17? Maybe I should read it. No one's going to read. Kardama?
That which pervades the entire body, we should know to be indestructible. No one is able to destroy that imperishable soul.
So like it said in the Bible, whatso profiteth a man if he gains the entire world, but loses his eternal soul. So the soul is what we're interested in because that's permanent. You get to keep it. It is you. It's not something you get to keep it. It is you. And the symptom of the soul is what? Consciousness. Cogito ergo sum. Where's that from? Does anyone know? Descartes. He said, I not only think. Think is not the good translation. I'm aware, therefore I am. I'm aware, therefore I am, therefore you exist. And consciousness is not an epiphenomena. Here's a big word for you. Epiphenomena. of matter. It doesn't come about because you put the right microprocessors in your computer and you have the right size hard drive and memory and everything like that. Computers cannot be conscious. They can emulate consciousness. Okay? And then Krishna talks about how the soul is not equal to the super soul in quantity, but it's equal in quality. You understand the difference? Like the soul's nature is Satchitananda, but the soul has a small amount of Satchitananda. And the super soul of Krishna is unlimited eternity, bliss, and knowledge. Here we got some more diagrams. Super soul is infinite. Vibhu can't be overcome by Maya, and the super soul is the witness in everyone's heart. Whereas the soul is infinitesimal and not only can be overcome by Maya, but usually is. And he thinks himself the doer, but he's actually the sufferer of this world. Okay? And text 18 to 25, we talk about the qualities of soul. Remember, this is all part of karma yoga, even though it's some jnana here, because it's the main focus is on karma yoga, doing your duty. So even the jnana that's being presented is for the purpose of karma or duty, like this. So 21, who's going to read 21?
How can a person who knows that the soul is indestructible, eternal, unborn, and immutable, kill anyone or cause anyone to kill?
In other words, there's several explanations of this. First of all, one who knows the eternality of the soul is not going to go killing people. And secondly, even if the government has this kills a murderer or something like that, they're not killing the person because the soul is eternal. So that's the end of this part of, there's the second part we're going to go over today. We're not finished yet. This part, I hope to finish the second chapter. Let's see, folders. All right. Let's see. Chapter 2B. Here we go. Text 26. Someone want to read text 26?
If, however, you think that the soul or the simple life is always born and dies forever, you still have no reason to lament or worry.
So what Prabhupada talks about here, this is actually in reference to Prabhupada's purport, that we're not just a bunch of chemicals, which is what the body is, a bunch of chemicals and other physical elements. We're the soul within the body. Text 27 and 28. Who wants to read both those together?
One who has taken his birth is sure to die, and after death one is sure to have to take birth again. Therefore, in the unavoidable discharge of your duty, you should not lament.
Text 28.
All created things are unmanifest in their beginning, manifest in their interim state,
And text 29. These are all descriptions about the eternality of the soul and why one shouldn't lament about these things. It's inevitable. All right, text 29 now. Who wants to read that? And the description here is that different types of people misunderstand the nature of the soul. Why do they misunderstand? Because they're not approaching the proper source of knowledge. There's three types of people who don't understand. One is that these are the three types dealt with here, the speculators. That means basically empiricists. People just understand things, seeing is believing. Those who engage in over a sense gratification, that means thinking the goal of life is just to enjoy these material senses, the Epicurean philosophy, eat, drink, and be merry, or tomorrow you will die, for tomorrow you will die. Or the Vedic version of the Epicurean philosophy is given by the sage Charvaka Muni, who states, beg, borrow, or steal, but get yourself some ghee. Has anyone heard that before? That's Charvaka. He's the Vedic Epicurean. Epicurean means someone who likes to eat and enjoy life, and he doesn't care what the future will hold. And, of course, then there's also the impersonalist. These three types of people cannot understand the nature of the soul. So, let's go back. So, 6:30, let's see, so we'll summarize. Text 31 to 38 deal with more karmakanda. That means reasons for following Krishna's orders, not so much with bhakti. So, in, here we are. Text 31, who wants to read 31? So Krishna is talking about prescribed duties within the Varnashram system, and he's indicating, this is actually, the next text goes on that, yeah. He's indicating that if one performs his dharma, everyone has their own swadharma according to their psychophysical nature. We talked about this last week, that there's a spiritual swadharma and there's a psychophysical swadharma. Spiritual swadharma is devotion to Krishna or bhakti yoga, which we perform. But we also have a psychophysical swadharma. What that means is that each and every one of us has an inclination towards a particular type of work. Krishna talks about this later on in the Gita, in the famous verse, Chaturvarnam Ayashrishtam, Guna Karma Vibhagasha. He talks about the Varnashram system, which later on became perverted as the caste system. The stratified caste system where you had people assuming a particular role of society because they were born in a particular situation in a particular family, just because they were called Sharma or Trivedi or Rao or something like that, they were considered Brahmins. And if someone was called a Topiwala, you know, then he was considered like a Vaishya or a Shudra. So that's not what Krishna is indicating here, that everybody has a specific. You can tell what your psychophysical nature is very easily. What do you like to do? It doesn't take an astrologer to figure that out. Just put in front of you, you just put a hammer and nails, a gun, some gold, and a bhagavatam. And blindfold yourself and just take off the blindfold real quickly. Where do your eyes go to? That, just ask yourself, very easy. That test was actually given to the Pandavas after they had won Draupadi, and they went to see King Drupada. He put these things in front of them. Many of us would be attracted to the gold. That's why we have, for the children, this ceremony where you put in front of them these four implements, and the children at about 6 or 8 months of age choose those things. I remember I chose the gold. No, I didn't have that ceremony. I'm just joking. So most of you born in India had this particular ceremony performed. And it would predict your ultimate nature. Of course, you can change your nature too. We're not saying that because one is Shudra by inclination or Vaishya or Brahman, that they cannot go up or cannot go down by the proper process of bhakti. So these are the swadharma. So this swadharma, that is the Varnashram system, has to be strictly applied when one is not self-realized. In other words, a perfectly pure devotee. A perfectly pure devotee has no duty to perform. Absolutely no duty. He's absorbed in Krishna consciousness 100%, but he sets an example, as we'll hear later on. So a self-realized soul sets an example, follows his swadharma, so that other people are not disturbed. Text 32, who wants to read text 32?
Upasa, happy are the Kshatriyas to whom such fighting opportunities come unsought, opening for them the doors for the heavenly planets.
So here's the Vedic explanation of why someone should do their duty and why Arjuna should fight in this war. Because win or lose, you win. It's pretty good, isn't it? So if you win, you enjoy the earthly kingdom. And if you lose, you go to heaven. That's more enjoyable. But the problem with both of those things, of course, Krishna doesn't deal with the problem of both these explanations right now, is what is the problem with both those? They're what? Yeah, they're temporary. Because if you enjoy the earthly kingdom, you have to leave your body. And if you enjoy heaven, shune punya marcha lokam vishanti. What? When your good karma runs out, your garland starts to fade. That's the first sign. When your garland starts to fade, you're on your way out. And choo, you come down to this earth planet and you take birth, maybe in America, maybe in India. Who knows? You're taking your chances. But therefore, Krishna is giving some material arguments here. Try to understand that. This is not Krishna's ultimate instruction. He's trying to use logic and reason and karma, you know, the whole process of karma, even the process of karmakanja, to argue or to defeat Arjuna's desire not to fight. Now, why is he doing that? Why doesn't Krishna just say, hey, surrender, give up all these varieties of religiosity and surrender to me, like he does in the last chapter of the Bhagavad Gita? Does anyone have any ideas why he doesn't do that? He's not ready, but Arjuna's a pure devotee. How can you say he's not ready? Hey, you're committing an offense. What? Right. Right. Arjuna's acting like us, so we can hear the Gita. Because Arjuna's an absolutely pure devotee. He was under the influence of yoga maya. We are under the influence of what? Mahamaya. Our illusion is real. It's really real. You can touch it, feel it, see it, smell it, taste it. We are in Maya. Or as they say in the South, Ma. It's a Southern accent. Maya. So we're, but there's this yoga maya, which is Krishna's internal potency, which puts his devotees into a little forgetfulness for his purposes. Like the devotees in the spiritual world, they're forgetting Krishna's God so they can play with him. And if you remember that Krishna's God, who's going to play with him? Not really. If my friend, I just found out my friend was God, I ain't playing with him. I'm going to ask him for some things, like a new computer, a new car, you know, money to build the temple across the street. You know, I got a lot of other things to do with him before I play soccer with him. You know, I ain't playing with God. That's the last thing I want to do. You know, I'm afraid, you know, because if you play with someone, guess what happens? Your feet touch them sometimes, isn't it? You go wrestling with someone, you're on the same, like Arjuna, on the same bed with someone, you know, hey, buddy, hey, God, how you doing? How's the spiritual world going, buddy, you know? Seen any nice gopis lately? You know, you don't do that. I'm being a little facetious and humorous about the thing, but... Wait for the end, please. So when you understand someone is God, then you're really careful about dealing with him. So the people in the spiritual world, they forget. Mother Yashoda is thinking Krishna is my what?
My son, my baby.
My baby! And Radharani is thinking Krishna is my boyfriend. And the coward boys are thinking Krishna is my buddy. My buddy, and I can fight with him. I can fight with him, I can challenge him, I can wrestle with him. So, anyway, so this is the conscious, this is yoga maya. So Arjuna is under this yoga maya. So he's apparently an illusion about the nature of the soul. Why is he apparently an illusion about the nature of the soul? So he can ask the questions that we need to hear the answers of. Because he is like every man. You understand this word? Every man, or every woman, or every person, or every entity? Because we're experiencing the same thing. Obviously, we're not fighting a battle right now, Kurukshetra, you know, but we have this internal battle going on. We have the battle with our senses. We have a battle whether to do our dharma, whether to take up spiritual life, whether to become more engrossed in material life. I mean, it's a continual battle. And so the questions and answers are very much applicable for us. So therefore, that's why Krishna is giving like some logical answers that aren't his ultimate answer here, because he's progressing through the Bhagavad Gita. Send your relatives to heaven. Another thing Krishna says to Arjuna, you know, even if they die, they go to heaven. Wow, I can send my relatives to heaven by killing them. But not killing relatives, but this is because his relatives were on the side of irreligion and they were interfering. They were actually interfering with people's life, liberty, and the pursuit of spiritual happiness, as they say in America, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so, text 33, who wants to read 33? This is interesting, I like this. These are more material arguments here. Two material arguments. Sin, you know, you're gonna suffer, you're gonna go to hell. You know, what does sin mean? Go to hell, you're gonna be punished, isn't it? A lot of people do religious things or spiritual things because of fear. Here's a fear argument here in the beginning. And the second one is reputation. Arjuna was very interested in reputation because he's a kshatriya. And a kshatriya is in the mode of what? Passion. When you're very passionate, you like appreciation, adulation, that means worship. And so if someone criticizes you, you see this sometimes, even amongst some of the people I deal with, they're all worried about reputation. What if people say this about me? The rumor mill. I just read this about myself on the internet. Is it true? I don't remember it. You know, so... So a Brahmin, except for his preaching purposes, he's not concerned with reputation. Right? You read about... to find out about myself, I read the internet. Because I don't really know what I do every day. So a Brahmana, other than preaching purposes, is not interested in what people say about him, because if people criticize me, it helps me become detached from this world. Whereas a Kshatriya... He's like, you know, let's say one of these sports heroes. Hmm. Like you remember, and none of you would remember Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali. He used to go around saying, what was his famous saying? I am the greatest. Like that. You know, huh? He wasn't the greatest. And so this is the kshatriyas, they like to establish, just like you see these sporting games like soccer and football, whatever games people play, you know, after the team wins, what do? The winning team, what do they do?
They shake hands.
They shake hands. What do? They go out there and they go what? They embrace each other and parade around the fields going like this, isn't it? I've seen that sometimes. And then just recently, of course, India won some particular match, and then New Zealand won, what was it? New Zealand won the rugby or something like that, the rugby championships or soccer or something. I don't even know the difference. So, I'm not educated this way. And so the whole country shut down for a week, you know, because everybody was rejoicing. And if you lose, has anyone heard of the soccer riot? They kill each other, you know, burn the stands and everything like that. So the kshatriya is very much into the sort of reputation business, my good reputation. Okay, whereas a Brahmin, criticize me, make my day. Like Lord Rishabhadev, when he left his position as king, he took up this process called Jata Yoga. Does everyone know what Jata Yoga is? Jata Yoga means where you just like walk around like an urchin, like a stupid person around the street. And everyone was like throwing horrible things at him, passing Aaron, and you know, anyway. And so he voluntarily did that so he'd be detached from this world so he could be absorbed in Krishna consciousness. I'm not saying you should do that. We have enough problems with people doing these things. But basically, one absorbed in spiritual life, like Gorgashordas Babaji Maharaj, he asked for his bhajan kutir to be in what? A toilet or a latrine. One rich man came to him and said, I want to build a nice house for you. A nice bhajan kutir. And he said, all right, there's your latrine. I want a room in it. And so they cleaned it up and everything like that. So that's one thing the spiritualist will sometimes do. He's not concerned with reputation. Okay, in text 33 to 36, Krishna describes additional losses. Arjuna, there's Arjuna. What? Doesn't look like him, but looks like us when I was younger. Arjuna will suffer if he neglects his duties. Let's go on to that. Text 37. All right. Who wants to read text 37? This is very interesting.
O son of Kunti, either you will be killed on the battlefield and attain the heavenly planets, or you will conquer the enjoy the earthly kingdom. Therefore, get up and
good. And so he's dealing with Arjuna's argument, I will not enjoy. Because Arjuna's first argument was, how can I enjoy if my relatives are killed? Or how can I enjoy? So he was really on that platform, at least manifesting that platform. Krishna wants Arjuna to fight. And Krishna's reason is, dead or alive, that's an interesting statement, you will enjoy. And, of course, you see that materialistic argument used sometimes improperly with different groups. You know, if you kill yourself or something like that. But that's not really the case, that if you do some horrendous activity, you're going to go to heaven and be greeted by all the virgins and all that other stuff like that. No. If God is there and telling you to do something, that's one thing. But if it's just your imagination or a political person or some soldier telling you to do that, only when Krishna is directly there. How do you know when Krishna is directly there? Does anyone know? You know, certain characteristics. He's all attractive, plays a flute. Super famous, super beautiful, super intelligent. Then you know Krishna's there. I mean, anyway, you have no doubt when you meet Krishna, believe me. So, under those circumstances. So Krishna's using this it's a material argument. It's not a spiritual argument. Dead or alive, you will enjoy, boy. Text 38. Let's read 38. I don't know if we'll finish with this chapter today.
Do thou fight for the sake of fighting, without considering happiness or distress, loss or gain, victory or defeat. And by so doing, you shall never incur sin.
So here Krishna is dealing with the sin thing that Arjuna was actually very concerned with. That if I fight, I will be very, very sinful. And so Krishna is saying, if you carry out your duty, you will not incur sin. And if you don't carry out your duty, you will incur sin. So it's still the materialistic argument. And this is what Krishna is presenting here is nishkama karma yoga. That means acting for Krishna without desire. So he's bringing it to a little higher level here. He said, if you do nishkama, but he's using the reason for it, not as pure devotion. You understand? But the reason for it is to avoid sin. You do your work in knowledge, and you're detached from the fruits. So Krishna's building up for this nishkama karma yoga, this action for Krishna without desire, by his previous descriptions in text 11 to 30 about the body and the soul being different, and you can gain pleasure by doing this nishkama karma yoga and avoid suffering. That's text 31 to 38. And 38 he says do both. So work, karma, and jnana, and knowledge with detachment yields nishkama karma yoga. That's an important designation. Nishkama, without desire. Karma means work. Yoga means connection with Krishna. So here's some more explanations. Nishkama karma yoga. It's Buddha yoga. One performs nishkama karma yoga. There's no reaction. One attains Brahman. And with knowledge of Krishna, one also. So here's a higher branch of nishkama karma yoga. With knowledge of Krishna, one also performs nishkama karma yoga. No attainment, but then he attains, no reaction, sorry, but he attains pure devotional service. So it depends on your motivation. You know, devotees also, someone who's doing bhakti also performs nishkama karma yoga. But his motivation is not to avoid sin or to get happiness. It's to please Krishna. It's to develop love for Krishna. So this type of karma yoga, nishkama karma yoga, is contained within bhakti. Bhakti, within bhakti, automatically, if you're doing bhakti, automatically, you're doing nishkama karma yoga. Does everyone understand that? But if you're doing this karma, karma yoga, it doesn't mean that automatically you're doing bhakti, because there's two types of nishkama, karma yoga. It's a little technical here. Everyone understands it? I think it's an important point. So you get a different destination. You either go to Brahman, if you're doing it for your own self, or you get pure devotional service and go back to Godhead. So here's in text 38, he also deals with renunciation. Because we all like to go on vacation, right? So, Krishna later on deals with the renunciation of the three modes of material nature, later on in the Bhagavad Gita. But here, he's dealing with a misunderstanding of renunciation that means no work. And that doesn't mean no work. Does it mean inactivity, giving up work, going on vacation, playing golf? No. What it means is to work, but to renounce the fruits of work. To do your prescribed duty, your dharma, but not to take credit and not to take the fruits of your work. There's a little yes there. As those who like computers, but that's an old sign from Windows 98 or something like that. So I think maybe that's all we have time for today. I don't want to push it. No, we've gone on for about 47 minutes. So we can take quick questions about any of this. Is perfect for
this last point. Can you say a little bit more about how we can not accept the fruits?
Okay. So in material nishkama karma yoga, let's deal with both of them. You just act to be detached, and actually what you're attached to is going to heaven. You understand what I mean? You have some attachment, but you're not attached to those specific fruits. In other words, you fight the fight, but you're not trying to win. I mean, you are trying to win, I'm sorry. But you're not trying to enjoy the result of the fight. You just want to go to heaven. That's material nishkama karma yoga. Or you want to go to Brahman, as mentioned here. But spiritual nishkama karma yoga, you're fighting and you're giving the fruits to Krishna. You're doing it for the pleasure of Cuba, of Krishna. Not Cuba. You're doing it for the pleasure of Krishna. You understand?
Yeah.
That's bhakti. That's the karma yoga that's contained within bhakti, is you're doing it for Krishna's pleasure. He's getting the results. And therefore, you go back to home, back to Godhead. So, that's why sometimes it says karma yoga and bhakti yoga are the same, but it's only referring to that type of karma yoga. Not the karma yoga where you're doing it for going to the heavenly planets or merging into the Brahman. So it depends on your motivation and what you're trying to accomplish with it. That's the difference between bhakti and just pure karma yoga. That in bhakti, you just want to give pleasure to Krishna. And in pure karma yoga, you're doing it for advancement, your own self-centered advancement. Yeah.
I was just thinking about that before I came to Krishna consciousness and had the explanation from Srila Prabhupada about the time yoga. I think that yoga has a misunderstanding because not also the time yoga, you know, to be detached.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was this idea of just being detached, like you said, a much more impersonal understanding, but not with the idea of that there was any really. Besides your own self, there wasn't any other goal of your detachment. It's just more self-centered, that if you're detached, then you don't suffer.
Yeah. And also, there was another misunderstanding on top of that. The misunderstanding that most people I know have is that you do whatever you want to do, and you just be detached from it. That's not coming. Yeah, that's the common one I hear in India. That, you know, whatever I want to do, you know, whether my duty is, you know, taking out the trash or whether my duty is whatever it is, or going to the nightclubs at night. I mean, I've even heard that, you know, you know, I'm doing this, I'm going to the nightclubs, but I'm not really attached to it. I've heard that. You know, I'm exaggerating here to a certain extent. But the primary philosophy I've run into is whatever you do is karma yoga, as long as you're not attached to it. But that's not true. It's not karma yoga unless you're doing things according to the Vedic injunctions, and then you're not attached to it. That's material karma yoga. You're not even material karma yoga if you're not doing things according to the Vedic injunctions. Then you're just engaged in vikarma. There's two things that Krishna will deal with later on in the Gita, which is karma and vikarma. Technically speaking, of course, the word karma is used differently in different places according to the context. In this particular context, karma means acquiring some positive assets in your karmic bank account. And vikarma means doing things against the Vedic injunctions, which are sort of negative assets in your karmic bank account. And incidentally, it's not that one balances out the other. Sometimes we think like that. You know, that, you know, I did a lot of things, you know, I get drunk on the weekends, but during the week I do a lot of charitable activities, and it balances out the two. It doesn't. There's an interesting story that illustrates that. It's a story of King Riga. Some of you may know this story. Once upon a time there was a king, and he gave away a lot of cows in charity to the Brahmanas, like, I think, millions of cows. The story is there in the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. He gave away millions of cows in charity to Brahmins. Now, he made a little mistake. One of the cows, he gave away twice because it wandered back into his herd. So you would think that all the good stuff he did would eradicate the one little bad thing, right? You would think like that. He was on the karmic platform. But it didn't work like that. Because as soon as he left his body, because he was such a good guy, he got a choice. You want to have the good stuff first or the bad stuff? You got a little bad stuff, a lot of good stuff. And most of us, if confronted with that choice, would want to get the bad stuff out of the way. Right? Like when you eat a sandwich, you eat the crust first. I remember when I was young, I'd eat sandwiches, I'd eat all around it first. Or if I had an Oreo cookie, you eat the outside first before you get to the cream filling. Because that's the nectar. It's just you have to tolerate the crust of a sandwich so you can get to the inside, which is the real nice tasting stuff. So most of us would choose that, wouldn't we? So he chose to take the bad stuff first. And he had to become a lizard. But he had so much good stuff that he was saved by Krishna. So if you have to become a lizard, it's good to be saved by Krishna. So, okay, I think that's all we have time for today because we don't want to delay the prasadam. I want to thank everybody for listening so nicely. And we'll thank you very much.